Okay, now in the lead up to this evening's lecture, the university collaborated with the media group ourSay.org. The ourSay website links the online community to politicians, decision makers and commentators via social media, enabling people to pose and vote for questions that they want answered. In the online forum created for this event by ourSay, the most popular question was registered by Rhea Shelters. She got 136 votes, and here's the question. Over the past decade, we have seen the assassination of Osama bin Laden, the Guantanamo Bay detention of David Hicks, and many individuals' rights significantly curtailed as a result of being labelled a terrorist. Yet many of these terrorists do not consider themselves terrorists. As the consequences for being labelled a terrorist continue to intensify, what, in your opinion, is the difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter? Is it merely a difference in perspective?
That framework is commonly used to discuss the issue. A common phrase you've heard 1,000 times is that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. I think that's a pretty misleading way of describing the issue. You know, if questions aren't formulated correctly, it often prevents you from getting to a reasonable answer. There's no dichotomy between terrorists and freedom fighters. The freedom fighters are quite typically terrorists. So take, say, George Washington's army. I mean, they're, I suppose, freedom fighters, if anybody was. But they were carried out brutal terrorist acts. Now, that's why there was a huge flight of loyalists from the colonies after the rebels took over. Now, they were fleeing in terror writing letters from Nova Scotia saying they're dying in the snow, but they have to get away from these maniacs who won the war. In fact, the flight of refugees from the United States elsewhere was roughly on the scale of the flight of boat people from Vietnam after the Indochina War. And remember, they were fleeing from what was already the richest country in the world, and they weren't being drawn out. They were fleeing in terror. It was quite unlike Vietnam. And that's pretty typical. Most wars of liberation are civil wars. That's pretty standard. The American Revolution, for example, was in fact a civil war. If you look at the rough estimates, a rough estimate is about maybe a third of the population were with the rebels, about a third were with the loyalists, and a third wished they'd all go away. That's probably pretty normal. So there's no dichotomy, and that's just one of innumerable examples. Typically, wars of liberation do involve terror. I don't think they should. I'm not condoning it. I'm just describing a fact. So the real question is two questions. One, do we ever support terror? I don't think we should myself, no matter who's carrying it out. But the second question is, of the efforts at achieving some, say, political goal, which ones do we approve of and which ones don't we approve of? And what are the reasons? Well, that puts things in a different framework. As far as the concept terror is concerned, it's quite an interesting one. The concept entered modern, daily talk when the Reagan administration came in. When Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981, his administration declared that a prime focus of U.S. policy would be what they called state-directed international terrorism, a particular kind of terrorism. They described that as the plague of the modern age, a return to barbarism in our time, on and on with such similar rhetoric. That's the moment, 1981, when there's an academic field, like put it in quotes, there's an academic field that calls itself the academic study of terrorism, whatever you think about it. It took off right at that time. The debate and discussion about terrorism became a major topic then in the media and everywhere else. Actually, I started writing about it too, along with some friends, Edward Herman and others. we began writing about terrorism. However, the work that we did on terrorism cannot be included in the canon. And if you look back, you see it's excluded. And there's a very simple reason. I, for example, Ed Herman and others, defined terror as it is defined officially in the U.S. Code and in British law and in Army manuals, and by now in the declarations of the Security Council and the General Assembly. They all have definitions of terrorism, which, to my mind, are pretty good ones. And those are the definitions we kept to. But those definitions cannot be used for a very simple reason. If you use those definitions, it follows almost immediately that the United States is the leading terror state. Britain is not lagging far behind, and France is right behind. It's not terribly surprising. That's what imperial power is. Well, that's the wrong conclusion. And since it's the wrong conclusion, something must be wrong with the argument. And what's wrong with the argument, it's using the official definition of the word terror. And because of that, there's been in the academic profession and social science, international conferences, these have been going on, weighty volumes, have been written trying to define terror. And it's recognized on all sides that defining terror is a very difficult problem. And indeed it is. It's extremely difficult, to craft a definition which includes their terror against us, but not our much greater terror against them. That's hard. So therefore, it's a difficult problem. But I think there's a simple solution. Let's take the official definitions and just apply them honestly. If we don't like the conclusions, well, it doesn't mean we're doing the wrong thing. It means we've got to rethink why we don't like the conclusions and what the policies are that we don't like. So that's one question. The second question is which efforts at using violence or the threat of violence to attain political, ideological, and other ends, which ones we approve of and which ones we don't. I mean, I mentioned the American Revolution. I could have mentioned a ton of others. Take, say, the anti-apartheid struggle. By any measure I can think of, that was a struggle for liberation. The African National Congress, which led it, was in the forefront of a major struggle for liberation. On the other hand, it was a terrorist organization. The Reagan administration was not lying when it declared that the African National Congress was a terrorist organization. In fact, as they put it, it was one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. That was 1988, incidentally. 1988, the Reagan administration denounced the ANC, Mandela's ANC, as one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. Well, that's a vast exaggeration. Didn't come close to the Reagan administration itself, for example. But nevertheless, they did carry out terrorist acts. And on those grounds, the United States under Reagan continued to support apartheid South Africa, supported apartheid South Africa while it was carrying out crimes in the neighboring countries, Angola and Mozambique, which led to the deaths of about 1.5 million people and billions of dollars of damage. It's quite apart from what they were doing internally, but we had to support them because that's one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. Actually, Nelson Mandela himself was just taken off the terrorist list about 2 years ago. He can now come to the United States without special dispensation. Well, okay, that's, as I say, a wild exaggeration, but an exaggeration of something correct. This liberation struggle, a prime example of one, did use terror. We can say it shouldn't have done so. I don't think it should have, but it did, And it's just the wrong formulation. We should ask different questions. What is terror? Is there a reason why we don't use the official definitions, apart from the fact that they give conclusions which are considered unacceptable? Not a good reason, of course. And second, what kinds of use of violence or the threat of violence do we condone, and which ones don't? Those are hard questions, but different ones.
Okay, we've had a lot of questions. We've had a lot of questions about the occupation movement. And as you know, we've had occupations in Melbourne and Sydney which were violently disrupted not that long ago. So Luke Stanford has logged the following question on our Facebook page. What is your view of the Occupy movements currently spreading worldwide? Are they likely to elicit the desired long-term results? And how can the 99% realistically compete against the resources and power of the 1%?
Well, briefly, I think they're a pretty fantastic development, actually inspiring development. I mean, if you think about the comments I made at the very end, there has been a, you know, we've been living in a period of a kind of an unprecedented period. After hundreds of years of growth and development, the advanced industrial societies, the United States, Britain, and the lead, have entered into a period of stagnation, decline. It's not the same as American decline of power over the world. That's been going on for a long time. But internal decline for a majority of the population. And also kind of loss of hope, much less sense of hopefulness than there was. That's quite, doesn't have to happen. These are particular policy choices. Different ones can easily be adopted and thought of. Finally, there's a reaction to it. The Occupy movements are the first major kind of sort of spontaneous in a way, but now they've expanded and have many features in common. This is the first organized mass popular reaction to a major assault against the populations. And that's got to be important. Now, the very fact that it's taken place has already left, I think, a legacy of change that's going to remain, whatever their outcome is. Now, it's not going to be easy to go on. It's necessary to recognize that victories are not won quickly. There are short-term issues where they can make a big difference. Take the United States again. You can, I'm sure, find analogs here. In the United States, there's a budget commission meeting, bipartisan budget commission. It's due to come out with its bipartisan deficit commission. It's due to come out with its results toward the end of this month. It'll probably be deadlocked. You've been watching what's happened in Washington, you know why. It'll probably be deadlocked, at which point automatic procedures go into operation, which in fact are a kind of a dagger aimed at the heart of the society. It's planned that way. It's a trap. There's a trap set up which will do exactly the opposite of what the population wants. What the population thinks about the deficit is very clear. The United States is a very heavily polled society. We have a ton of information about it. Point number one is a large majority of the population thinks that the deficit is not a major problem. It's joblessness that's a major problem. I think they're right. And that's the overwhelming majority. So if democracy was functioning, you'd have a joblessness commission, not a deficit commission. But the financial institutions say it's the deficit, so that's what Washington does, independent of the public. So let's just take a look at the deficit. Well, the public has opinions about that, too. It says the deficit should be dealt with by restoring proper form of taxation on the very wealthy, the form of taxation that, in fact, was in place during the high growth period, 50s and 60s. That's been dismantled. By now, taxes on the super rich are ridiculously low, and the public wants them returned. Secondly, the public does not want the benefits systems attacked at all. They want them protected, and in fact, to grow. They're not very substantial in the United States. They're not like Australia, but they do exist, and the public doesn't want them changed. Well, you can be pretty sure that the bipartisan commission, if it has an outcome, and the automatic procedures, if it doesn't have an outcome, will do the opposite. They'll maintain the outrageous tax cuts on the rich that the Bush administration initiated following from the Reagan years. and they'll harm the limited benefits positions, benefits programs. Actually, there's another point which isn't mentioned in the media because the financial institutions don't want it. There's a very straightforward way of getting rid of the U.S. deficit, very straightforward. Simply institute the kind of healthcare system that other industrial countries have, say Australia or Canada or France. I mean, they differ, but there's things in common among them. Some kind of national healthcare system. That's highly efficient. I mean, there's plenty of things wrong with it, but you know that better than I do. But compared with the U.S. system of pretty much a privatized, more or less unregulated healthcare, it's quite efficient, also much more humane. Per capita healthcare costs in the United States are about twice as high as other industrial societies, and the outcomes are pretty poor in terms of, you know, infant mortality, usual measures. And it's also pretty savage. I mean, tens of millions of people just don't have healthcare. Or maybe they get it at an emergency room or something like that. It's extremely inefficient, very expensive, and quite savage. And in fact, if the U.S. simply adopted a healthcare system like other industrial countries, in the U.S. that could mean, for example, expanding Medicare, the medical insurance national program for the elderly, just extend it to the whole population. That would very sharply cut the deficit. In fact, it would eliminate it. It would, in fact, actually leave a surplus. But that can't be discussed, even though the population wants it, because the financial institutions are against it. And they now have such inordinate power that they determine what happens in Washington. Well, that's something that the Occupy movements could deal with very quickly. If they can reach a substantial enough scale, they could compel the large majority opinion in the United States to influence policy within the next few weeks. That's literally the case. I don't know if it'll happen, probably won't, but it could happen in the very short term. And there are other short-term issues that could be dealt with by a popular movement which in fact tries to introduce an element of functioning democracy into the system, an element savagely, seriously lacking. A similar comments hold of other industrial societies. I mean, different from one society to another. The United States is extreme in some sense. Well, what about the longer-term goals? They're very significant ones that could be implemented piece by piece, even beginning right now, and could lead to major changes. So let me give you an example from the United States again. Two or three years ago, the Obama administration essentially pretty much nationalized the auto industry. They didn't call it that. They took over the auto industry, which was collapsing. It was essentially in public hands. Well, there were several choices that could have been made. And one choice is the one that was made. Reconstitute the auto industry, you know, restructure it, fix it up, federal subsidies and so on, cut back wages, attack the unions, and then hand it back to the old owners or people very much like them, same banks and so on. That's what was done. That was one option. Another option, which wasn't done, was to turn the auto industry over to the workforce and the communities and to help them proceed to produce things that the country very badly needs. If any of you have been to the United States, you know, any time in the last couple of decades, you'll know that the country desperately needs a high-speed rail system. I mean, it's kind of a scandal. If I try to go from, say, Boston to Washington, it can take, by the fastest train in the country, it can take maybe 7 or 8 hours. Just recently, I was giving talks in France, and I ended up in southern France, and I had to take a train from Avignon to Paris, the Gaulle Airport, which is the same distance. That's Washington to Boston. It took 2 hours on a comfortable, quiet train. That's humanly significant. It's also economically significant. And these are things the country needs all over the place. Well, the same auto industries that were collapsing and their skilled workforce could be producing high-speed rail, could be doing it under community and worker control. There are small experiments with that which are working pretty well, maybe thousands of them. This would be a large one. And that could happen. That's not pie in the sky. It's pretty close to happening. And it could happen if there's a substantial popular movement which is in there for the long haul and is dedicated to making changes in the society. And that would be the beginning of a revolutionary change. And there's plenty of other things. Well, can it happen? You know, that depends on whether the Occupy movements can proceed with what's beginning to happen, but go on. I mean, one of the exciting things to watch and participate in the Occupy movements is the way they're just forming functioning democratic communities, you know, developing links, making associations, cooperative kitchens, you know, all kinds of things which are like the germs of a decent society. And it's kind of developing spontaneously. People are participating in it, learning, and so on. Well, if those can be strengthened, sustained, maintained against the certain repression which is coming, these, you know, those with power don't give it up easily. So if they can be sustained against that and can continue spread out into broader communities and so on, well, you know, could have a really major effect of historic significance. That's an optimistic view. I don't think it's totally unrealistic. But even if that's not reached, I think it's already made a major change. It's beginning to formulate and articulate the anger, frustration, fear that the population has felt, but has not had a way to carry forward in some constructive way. And this leaves a kind of legacy for that. And if you think about other movements, like, say, the civil rights movement, they didn't win their whatever results they got with a single march on Washington and Martin Luther King making a speech. That's mythology. The civil rights movement in the United States goes way back, but it really hard, you know, really hard work on it began in the 30s and the 40s, beaten back, repressed violently. In the early 60s, black students began sitting in lunch counters, freedom riders. They began trying to register voters. It was pretty brutal, a lot of people killed, a lot of violence. But they kept at it, and within a couple of years, there was a large-scale popular movement. Then you could get the March on Washington, Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream, voter registration legislation, a victory. Not an insignificant victory, though a very limited one, and far short of what King had in mind or what any of us should have in mind. But that's the way popular movements develop. That's the way society becomes more civilized.
All right, we're off to the Middle East now. The Australian government, only a few days ago, voted against Palestine's admission into UNESCO, voted with 14 opposing it. I think there were 52 abstentions and 107 in favour. So what does the two-state solution really mean in 2011? It's still the official policy of the Australian government to support a two-state solution. I think it's still the Obama administration's official position, stated position. But what does that really mean in 2011?
Well, that's up to Australia to decide. Australia is not a major player in world affairs, but, you know, has a role. And just like any individual one of us, you know, we're not major players, but we do have a role. And what's going on is very clear, I think. The Israel-Palestine problem, you know, conflict, at least in the short term, has a very straightforward solution. It's one of the simplest problems to solve. When you think of Kashmir or Eastern Congo or something, it's extremely hard even to dream up what could be a satisfactory solution. In Israel-Palestine, There's a short-term settlement, which is very straightforward and is agreed by virtually the entire world. It's the official position you mentioned. It's been pretty well understood. Two-state settlement on the internationally recognized border, pre-June 67 border, with minor and mutual modifications. That phrase is from official U.S. foreign policy in the early 70s, when the U.S. was still part of the world on this issue. Well, then there are other questions about what do you do about, you know, various other aspects of it. But that's the basic framework of a short-term settlement. I don't think it's a great settlement, but it's at least a step towards maybe something better. And it could seriously cut down violence, destruction, threats, make life better for everyone. What's blocking it? One thing is blocking it. For 35 years, the United States has been blocking it unilaterally. This proposal pretty much along those lines, it came to the Security Council in January 1976. It was advanced by the three major Arab states, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, the so-called confrontation states. It was vetoed by the United States. A similar proposal came in 1980, vetoed by the United States. It shifted to the General Assembly. Practically every year there was a vote with more or less similar proposals. They varied in wording, General Assembly resolutions. The votes were, 151-3, the United States, Israel, Palau, something like that. And that went on year after year. And there's a couple of modifications. I won't run through the whole details, but that's essentially what's happening. Now, the U.S. and Israel have a position, a definite position. They insist on negotiations, but with crucial preconditions. Now, that's not the way it's described. What's claimed is the Palestinians insist on preconditions for negotiations, and Israel says, no, let's just have them without preconditions. And, of course, the United States is an honest broker, throwing up its hands in despair at its inability to bring the two sides together. That's the official myth. The actuality is that the U.S. and Israel insist on crucial preconditions. One precondition is that the negotiations will be run by the United States. That essentially undermines any possibility of progress. I mean, if you take a look at the world stand on this issue, meaningful negotiations would be run by some neutral party, whoever you might pick, with the U.S. and Israel on one side and the world on the other side. Those would be negotiations. But the U.S. insists on a precondition. No, we, the partner of Israel in blocking a diplomatic settlement, we've got to control the negotiations. Well, that's consistent with what I was talking about all along. It's part of the system of making sure you control the Middle East and you don't permit others to interfere. Well, that's one precondition. The second precondition is that Israel must be free to continue its settlements in the occupied territories. Now, those settlements are unequivocally criminal actions, not just the expansion of the settlements, but the settlements themselves. Transfer of population into occupied territories is a major crime. It's a war crime, in fact. It's in violation of fundamental conventions of international law. And that's been recognized by every relevant authority, the International Court of Justice, the Security Council. In fact, Israel itself conceded it back in 1967. But they said, we'll do it anyway, as long as the U.S. backs us. So a second precondition is that they must continue to extend these criminal acts carefully designed to ensure that no viable Palestinian state can emerge, and as I mentioned before, that Gaza will be separated from the West Bank and kept under a siege. That's the second precondition. The third precondition, you can read in the newspapers right in the last few days. You presumably noticed that after Palestine asked for membership in UNESCO, Israel retaliated by immediately announcing new building programs in the West Bank and what they call Jerusalem, vastly expanded region that Israel annexed. The settlement programs in Jerusalem, I should say, are doubly illegal. First, because all the settlements are illegal, and secondly, because in Jerusalem, they are an explicit violation of specific Security Council resolutions going back to 1968, demanding that the status of Jerusalem not be changed. Now, if you look at Prime Minister Netanyahu's statements when he announced the current settlement programs in retaliation for the UN move, he said, doesn't really matter because these are in areas that will remain in Israel in any final settlement. Okay, what does that mean? That means he's saying we've got a precondition for negotiations, namely parts of the West Bank that we want, we're going to annex, period. That's a precondition for negotiations. Well, you know, with a framework like that, nothing's going to happen. This is a framework designed to allow meaningless negotiations to go on forever while Israel proceeds with U.S. backing to take over what it wants in the occupied territories. Okay? So what's the status of the two-state settlement? Well, you know, that depends on whether the world is willing to act. The most of the world, you know, whatever it was, 140 countries, whatever, they already insist on the international consensus, have for decades. Australia has tended to go along with the United States, not completely, but tended to. Okay, that's saying we don't want a settlement. We're willing to follow the master. We don't care what happens. Europe, with its typical courage, trails after the master. It's gone along with the United States on these issues. Europe is powerful enough to take an independent stand. It's kind of like what I was talking about before, following an independent path. But that's a European decision. If Europe joins the United States or it sort of backs away, Australia too, Canada too, then the United States and Israel would continue to block a settlement indefinitely until they get what they want. Palestinians are lost.
And that's their position, is to the status quo actually suits them because it enables them to encroach further.
Yeah, they just go further. And the status quo is fine as far as the U.S. and Israel are concerned. Okay. Israel has quite definite plans. They're not a secret. They're approximately what was called the Sharon plan at one time. It means that Israel takes over everything behind the what they call the separation wall. It's actually an annexation wall. That cuts through, about 85% of it cuts through the West Bank. It assigns on the Israeli side arable land, some of the major water resources, the nice suburbs of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and so on. That is what Netanyahu says, what we're going to take over permanently. They're also settling the Jordan Valley. There's a recent study by B'Tselem, the Israeli Human Rights Group, which gives some details of what Israel's doing in the Jordan Valley. I mean, hundreds of wells are being sunk, communities being established, vast areas where Palestinians are barred. These are the traditional steps towards slowly taking over the region. So that means that what's left of Palestine would be trapped between Israel's Jordan Valley takeover and its takeover of the land, you know, behind the annexation wall. The vastly expanded Jerusalem, it's about five times its original size, that's been annexed illegally. And in addition to that, there are, I don't know what you're saying, but I'll be glad to come back to it. In addition to that, there are salients cut through. You can see it on the maps. East of Jerusalem, there's a salient going to the east. It virtually bisects the West Bank, leading to the town of Ma'ale Adumim. That was built, it was started in the 70s, it was built mostly under Clinton in the 90s, and it essentially bisects the West Bank. There's another one farther north going through the town of Ariel, which bisects much of what's left. There's another one even beyond to another town. So you got these salients cutting through. They leave unviable cantons. They're huge infrastructure projects for Israelis only. Palestinians will be, they can rot up in the hills. I mean, Israel has recognized recently that it makes sense to establish a traditional neocolonial project. Any imperial colony or neocolonial system has a sector of extreme wealth. I mean, you can go to the poorest country in sub-Saharan Africa, and there's a sector of where people live in opulence way beyond what we can imagine. And Israel's doing the same thing, not to that extent. But in Ramallah, for example, you can live a kind of a Western life, nice restaurants, theaters, and so on. So that's the elite sector that, while the rest of the country becomes kind of a desperate third world. Gaza, of course, is just a prison, a prison kept at the barest level of survival, because they don't want to have absolute genocide, too much reaction. Well, that's what's developing. And if Australia continues, say, to vote with the U.S., they're helping it.
I'm conscious. The audience won't know that you've been up since 6 a.m. this morning, and I don't want to stretch the friendship too far. And I know the Auslan people behind are doing an incredible job on the side of the stage trying to interpret all this. So we've got one final question, and that is, what on earth is going on with the Republican Party primaries? On this side of the Pacific, we're not quite sure whether it's reality TV or this is they're preparing people to take over the country in the next election.
You're not the only one. I've been in Europe a couple of times the last couple of months, and people can't believe what's going on. In fact, in the United States, it's hard to believe it. This is something that has no precedent, as far as I know, in the history of parliamentary democracy. I mean, it's kind of a freak show. It literally is. I don't know if you've been following it. It's kind of shocking. And it's the continuation of a process that's been going on for 30 years. During this period I described, this kind of roughly neoliberal period, the Republican Party has increasingly ceased to become a traditional political party, a party that participates in parliamentary interactions. I mean, maybe you like them, maybe you hate them, but at least they're somehow functioning in a parliamentary framework. They've ceased. Now the party is, and for years, in fact, the party has been so deep in the pockets of corporate America, in particular the financial sector, that you need a telescope to find them. You look at their policies, that's what they are. Well, no political party can survive unless it has voters. And you're not going to get voters from 0.1% of the population. So they've had to try to develop a different mass base, some mass base that'll tolerate this. And what they've been compelled to do, it's hard to think of an alternative, is to appeal to some of the elements of American society and culture, which have always been there, but are not very attractive and have been never been mobilized politically before. So just to take one example, it's been known for decades, plenty of studies. If you do comparative studies of religious extremism, the United States is just off the spectrum, literally. Like about a third of the population believes in the literal truth of every word of the Bible. About half the population thinks the world was created a couple thousand years ago with all the fossils and everything else. I think about 85% believe in miracles. Roughly two-thirds expect the second coming. most of them within our lifetimes if we act properly, you know. I mean, these are, whatever you think about these things, they're just off the international spectrum. Even in extremist Islamic fundamentalist societies, you don't have comparable things. This, it sort of goes way back. It goes back to the colonists, who were pretty much religious fanatics. But it's just a feature of American society, you know, love it or hate it. And there are other things, like the fear. It's a very frightened society. It always has been, back to the earliest days. You see it in popular literature. It's part of the gun culture. You know, people have guns because they're afraid. What are they afraid of? You know, it's the most secure country in history. But they're terrified. I mean, I know people who, there are people who are well-known scientists, in fact, who are survivalists, meaning they have a barn full of, you know, assault rifles or whatever you stick in those things. And they're going to defend themselves against who? You know, well, I'll give you, you look at the examples, it's frightening. The state of Indiana, you know, Midwest state, a couple of years ago, had to tear down all of its highway signs. Why? Because, the signs that say turn right at the next light or something. It's signs, it turns out, have a code on them, presumably for the people who clean the highways or something. And a rumor started spreading that that code was for the United Nations, which is planning to commit genocide against the American people. And people see black helicopters coming, which are from the United Nations, and they're planning to descend on us and destroy us, and those codes are for them. So people started tearing out the signs. And the state literally had to replace all the signs and take the codes off. It's a very frightened society. You ask why people have guns? Well, one of the Republican congressmen who's been in the lead of maintaining gun rights told the New York Times, we have to have our guns because when the federal government comes after us to take away our rights, we're going to defend ourselves. I mean, you know, you can't even call it paranoia, it's so far out, but it's a definite feeling. And there's a lot of things like this, and the Republicans, to the extent that they're a party, have mobilized them. That's their mass base. They can't have a mass base of people who support their policies, because nobody supports their policies. And what you end up with is this show that you're seeing. It's a very, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate, but you know, I'm just about old enough, so it has some resonances. It's a little bit like what happened in late Weimar Germany. You know, there are plenty of differences, but enough similarities to be frightening. Germany, remember, in the 1920s, was the absolute peak of Western civilization in the sciences, in the arts. It was considered a model of democracy. It was as advanced as Western civilization could be. A couple of years later, it was the absolute depths of history, you know. Part of what happened is that there was just a loss of respect for the central institutions of the society. People began to hate the political parties. They hated the wrangling in parliament. They wanted to get rid of everything. Nothing was working. Everyone was against them. The world was attacking them, the unfair Versailles settlement and so on. And kind of a paranoia spread. And a charismatic figure came along. And we know what happened next. It wasn't very, very nice. I don't think that's going to happen, but there's enough similarities to be at least worrisome.
Well, I'm sorry we're going to have to draw the questions to a conclusion. I know you must be exhausted. But thanks very much. Yeah.